Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 178. This week, Carl and I talk about all of the news that's been piling up in January. Are you too old to program? How hackers are stealing all of your info. And Carl tries to troll me, but I'm totally right.
Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications. Check it out today at raygun.com.
Hey, Carl, how's it going?
It is going really good.
It's been way too long since we've spoken. So, I guess we've spoken. We haven't recorded an episode, though.
Yeah, we just got to remember to record these.
Yeah, we'll just start recording random conversations with, I'll just carry like a hidden mic or something. But the good news is we are queuing up tons of amazing episodes. So just next week, we're going to be talking to Susan Hinton about live coding. She's awesome on Twitch. We're going to talk to Jeffrey Snover about PowerShell. We're going to have a great guest on for blockchain. And we are just loading up the queue. So we're going to keep that queue that just piled high so that we can keep these episodes going strong.
And if you guys have any topics you want to hear about that we haven't, feel free to pile on. I've heard people wanting to hear about Docker and Kubernetes, mm-hmm. Stuff like that. So those are definitely things we want to get on our radar.
Yep. That one is coming up as well. And I'm super excited about that one. I'll be talking about that a little bit later. So what do we have for the comment of the week?
The comment of the week, we got on Twitter from Jayanta Sharma. She said, hello, everyone. I'm exploring new things in 2018 and came across your podcast channel. I saw the episode Personal Learning, and it's great. Thanks for the tips, guys. Jayanta wasn't the only one that had some positive feedback on the show. Apparently, a lot of you want us to talk about our side projects more often. Unfortunately, we can only have so many side projects, yeah. But as we are doing interesting things, it is good to be reminded that you guys want to hear about those. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the other episodes that we have lined up coming up is something I hinted at from the side projects thing. So because of some of the stuff I was doing with Project Centennial, we will be having another episode on that.
Yeah, that's so cool. There's only a handful of Centennial developers on the planet, and we have one of them as our co-host, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So if you want to get mentioned on the show like Jayanta, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com, comment on Facebook, YouTube, or Stitcher, and we really like those 5-star iTunes reviews.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool name, by the way.
It is.
Yeah. So let's get into the news, which is what we have pretty much the whole episode. We have a couple different picks of the week that we will cover. But basically, we have just lots. There was lots of great stuff going on in January. You know, December is always a little bit quiet, but January really picks up and there's some product releases. There's things like CES. So we just have a lot to talk about. So the first one here, I actually have no idea what it is. It says totally not trolling Jason, and it has instructions here not to read it. Am I allowed to read it now?
Yeah, open it up. This is a picture. It says, for those working with time zones, I'm sorry, this map may be some of assistance. So this visualizes all of the time zones very clearly in the world. And in fact, time zones are more complicated than this map even shows.
Yes.
There are, you know, states and counties and towns that do weird things.
Well, they're excluded, right? Like, I think Phoenix is one of them, for example. Where,
yeah, I think Indiana has some odd rules with that. And even there's new things. I heard some of the states on the eastern part of the U.S., instead of doing daylight savings, they just want to move one time zone over permanently.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's what I want. I just on the fly, this enrages me and made me think of an idea. So we need to print up some stickers. Okay, and maybe we can just put MS Dev Show like really fine print at the bottom. But what it needs to say is... stop the insanity in giant letters, and then in smaller letters, it'll say abolish time zones. Maybe we should say abolish time zones and DST. And then, and then in tiny print, it'll say msdevshow.com. That way it's still promoting the show. Yeah. And I will stick that sticker. I only have an MS Dev Show sticker on my laptop, but I will stick that sticker on my laptop. So, if somebody wants to design those up, that would be much appreciated. And then I will order some of those, and then we can start handing those out. Carl probably will not hand them out, but I will hand them out.
I've got plenty of other things to hand.
Yeah, I know. So. I know, but I will excitedly hand these out. It's just insanity. I mean, these things, they're like, you know, I get that the maps are like a Mercator projection. But like these lines are just wacky in here. Like you have to, you know, go to the MS Dev show and take a look at our show notes so you can see a picture of this. But I mean, this is just insanity. So am I reading this right? Like all of Europe is on the same time zone? I guess other than Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, but I mean like Poland, Germany, Sweden, Norway, France, Spain, Italy, like they're all the same time zone. It looks like.
Well, I mean, really there's like four time zones there. I mean, the UK is kind of in its own little thing. Then you have Western Europe, kind of Central Europe is that little red band. And then, Eastern Europe is blue there. So it does cover a fair amount, but when you look at China, China's all one time zone. When it obviously looks, when you compare it to the rest of the world, it would cover five or six.
I love China. Yeah, that's right. Cause China, I mean, it's like as wide as the United States.
They're just like buzz off guys.
Yeah.
You know what's up.
Yeah. See a lot of smart people over there. Japan, all of Japan's the same time zone. No, that's a joke. Cause they're so small. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of these geographic areas that would cover multiple time zones in the United States, are all in the same time zone. So it could be done. So maybe a baby step, you know, I do want to just completely abolish them throughout the world, but I realize that it's difficult to make sweeping changes across the entire planet. So maybe as a start, we just commit that the entire United States will be one time zone, including Alaska and Hawaii. It's not just continental. And then
what about U.S. territories? Cause then you have like Guam and that's pretty much almost, you know,
I'm not very good in politics. I assume we have are we capable politically of making that change? Is that within our power?
Well, they are a U.S. territory. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, I think the answer is yes. I just wanted to confirm before I said something stupid. So, yeah.
When has that stopped you before?
Yeah. So let me state this in a more simple way. Any place that we are able to and have authority to switch to the one true time zone. You know what? I'm just going to say it right now. The one true time zone should be +8, which is China, because they're trendsetters here. So let's adopt that time zone. And it'll be really awesome because whenever you try to schedule a meeting with China, you will know the exact time that it is over there. So that's a huge benefit. Think of the relationship with China, how much that would improve. And then all you have to know, like right now I have no idea, like, you know, what time it is in China, if it's day, night, whatever. But if you just told me, hey, nighttime starts, you know, at this time and daytime starts at this time, I could commit that to memory and I would know forever. So it's all upside. So are we in agreement, Carl? Or are you gonna
I'm cool strong, with it. It makes scheduling things easier. I mean, okay. Look at all the work that you put into our scheduling page.
Yeah.
Which only our guests really know about. But yeah. I mean, that's a lot of just time zone craziness.
Yeah, that was half the time was just making it support the time zones correctly. Because my calendar is theoretically Pacific time and the viewer's calendar is theoretically anything. They could be in China.
Mine is central and our guests could be anywhere throughout the world.
And I actually suspect that if, you know, so during the summer, whenever I go on this big RV trip, if I switch into a different time zone, so if I travel at all into a different time zone, it will actually switch my Outlook calendar time and that page will start to be incorrect. So we're going to have a problem. I don't know how we're going to handle that. Somehow I'm going to have to stay within Pacific time.
Just leave your laptop at home and remote into it.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. Okay. Well, let's talk about a lighter topic. Let's talk about net neutrality. And I don't think we've talked about net neutrality much on the show. I guess the simple thing for us to say on net neutrality, because people, you know, I think everybody who listens to the show probably understands it. This show wouldn't be possible if not for net neutrality. In fact, the lack of net neutrality on cellular already hurts us, right? I mean, if you are an AT&T customer, you can watch DirecTV for free. It's zero rated. They don't, the data, well, you have to pay for DirecTV. They charge you 10 bucks a month, but the data does not count toward your plan. But if you listen to the MS Dev show, that data does count toward your plan. So we, as from a data perspective, cost more than DirecTV, which obviously doesn't help us.
No.
So we want everything being treated the same.
But what was really interesting was you found this article where Burger King mm-hmm. had done something very clever to illustrate what net neutrality is to its customers. So you want to tell us what they did, Jason?
Sure. And I'm not sure how technically accurate this is, but I don't really care because it's super fun. Basically what they did, I'm going to pull up a picture of the sign. So they actually had, well, first of all, what's hilarious is on their menu, the word Whopper, the O is the progress sign from like iOS, like the loading symbol. So like they've already won just by using that symbol. That is hilarious. But basically they now have three different types of Whoppers, and they tried this they did this as a stunt, we'll say, in one of their stores. But it says Whopper, the title is Whopper MBPS. And there's a little asterisk and it says making burgers per second. So you can get the slow MBPS Whopper for $4.99.
There's which a fast, the regular price apparently.
Right. There's a fast. Yeah, man, these sandwiches have gotten expensive. Fast MBPS Whopper, which is $12.99. And then there's the hyper fast MBPS Whopper, which is $25.99. And basically people come in and they say, I want a Whopper, and they would not give it to them right away. They'd forcibly make them wait, even if it was done. Even if the Whopper was already made, they're like, it's right there. You're like, please hand it over. In the one case, the guy's like, I can hand it to you, or I can give it to you in 42 seconds. And he's like holding the Whopper in the bag and he's just withholding it, which is what's going on. Right. I mean, the ISPs, like they play games with all these different numbers, but basically they can do that, right? The next person who walks in the door who is willing to pay more for their Whopper gets it immediately. And that's what they watch, right? Somebody would come in, and I'm guessing those people were, it was basically a setup, right? They had somebody come in and they'd order the hyper fast Whopper. They'd get their Whopper before all the other people would place their order, and they'd walk out and then hilariously watch all the people start complaining in there. So obviously a stunt. Very amusing though. And, I feel like, you know, I'm not sure why Burger King did this, although I guess
they kind of have a history of doing things like this. They had a commercial where there was an anti-bullying thing, and they had like somebody like yelling at their burger and punching it. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And seeing who would stop them. They do some of these social justice things, just to, help make and raise awareness for whatever the topic is.
Yeah. So, I'm glad they did it, because I think it's amusing, and we definitely just, we have to like keep fighting this fight, because, while we don't expect any like, horrible things to happen quickly, like it's what happens over time. Prices start getting out of hand, and bundled deals start happening. And, we've already we've seen misuse of this in the past, and we've seen it happen in cellular. And yeah. Support the MS Dev Show and support net neutrality. okay, so let's change gear. Yeah, I love this because we're like switching gears like completely on every news story here. But the next one I'm really excited about because I have a DJI Mavic. DJI announced the Mavic Air.
Just to be clear, this is a drone.
Yeah, it's a drone. Yep. Actually, so before we even say that, I should also say there was another news story. So GoPro, they gave up on drones. So they're out of it. I mean, they had kind of
Hear that.
Yeah. So they signed up. Nope, we're no good at this. And I think they got rid of, I shouldn't say got rid of, they let go a few hundred employees, which is super unfortunate. But their, their product, I mean, DJI is just knocking it out of the park. And they have so much momentum at this point. Like it's getting really hard to compete with them. I mean, it's almost concerning. Luckily they are still innovating. So it still seems to be okay for consumers. But that's my only concern with having GoPro out of the race. I didn't really have any interest in the GoPro drone products. So first, let's talk about the pros. Like what is the deal with this thing? So the biggest pro, it's way smaller. Which is amazing because my Mavic is ridiculously small. It's like, what is it the size of? It's like the size of, like a rolled up phone book. Do people know what phone books are anymore? I don't know.
Why not?
Name an object. A loaf of bread would be bad. Maybe those like artisanal breads, like maybe like a French roll. It's like the size of like a small French roll. if that makes sense. That's probably terrible because there's so much variation there. Anyway, the Mavic is already tiny, the Mavic Pro, but this thing is even smaller. Like it's, yeah, of course I can't think of what size it is. You have to go, just go to their site and take a look, but it is super small. It folds up really tiny, which is great because it, you know, when the Mavic Pro came out, it was a total game changer in being able to take your drone with you. They used to have these gigantic backpacks that were laughable where you could take the old drones. And now you can, I just have this little bag. In fact, I can show it on video here. So right here, this tiny little bag here.
That's like a lunchbox.
Yeah, it's like a lunchbox size. This is literally all of my drone stuff. This is the Mavic itself. And I will open it and I will show you. And I know that only like 2% of our listeners actually watch the video. So I apologize to them. But here you can see it. It's my drone, the controller, an extra battery. I actually have an empty compartment here for yet an extra battery. And then it has all my chargers and everything in here as well. It's literally everything I need. It's super small. So it's great that the Air is even smaller. It also adds back obstacle sensing. So my drone, theoretically, when it's working properly, it has front sensors on it, and it won't let you drive it into stuff. And I've tried this at low speeds, you know, tried to like run it into a fence or something, and it just sits there, you know, like 10 feet away and sort of bounces off an invisible wall. But if you drive it back, or if you fly it backwards, you can fly backwards into things. And actually I did that one time. So it's nice that the Air has the back obstacle sensing added on. The cons on this new drone, there's no screen on the controller. So my controller has basically like an LCD, like black and white, you know, like the old school LCD, not like a full color screen. It has a screen on there that shows you like speed and direction, those types of things. I actually think that's immensely valuable because I lost connection, or I had my app crash on my phone one time and I couldn't see the camera anymore. And I didn't know which direction the drone was facing, and it was too far away for me to even see if I was flying it the right way. So I was actually able to use the distance indicator to fly it back. So I think that the fact that there's no screen on the Mavic Air is a huge disadvantage. They also lowered the range by a bit. Mine goes, I think mine's rated for like 4 miles. And I think
that's a lot.
Yeah. And obviously that's line of sight. But you can go, you know, if you're like going through the woods, you can go like, which sounds kind of crazy, but like if you're going up a river, right? So I've done that, and you go like around a bend. I can go like half a mile, thanks to like the proprietary wireless and protocol that they use. Whereas this one, the range is rated lower. It looks to be like about half or maybe like 75% of what mine is. You know, we'll have to see. It's a little bit different protocol, so we'll have to see what that does in the real world. Additionally, it has shorter flight time. So my drone will go almost a full half hour. It's rated for 27 minutes. And I can actually get that. Like drones now, they fly long enough that the flight time is like almost a non-issue. Like you kind of get bored of it after that amount of time. I mean, you've sort of recorded the thing that you need to record, and then you can pop in a different battery. So it goes for, the Mavic Pro is 27 minutes. This one is only 21 minutes, which I actually think is still pretty good. So I think it's fine. So basically my conclusion and my review in this whole thing without actually having seen this thing, anything that I didn't mention was basically the same, equal in specs, like the camera and all that is all equal, the 4K camera. So, my conclusion is if you do not have a drone and you are in the market for one, this would be my recommendation for what to buy. I would get the Mavic Air. It's $300 cheaper than the Pro. It's basically $799, which usually means that you'll be able to get them on sale for $700, or you can get, basically a pack like with an extra battery and a whole bunch of stuff for $800. So figure $800 or $900 total for this thing versus, $1,100 or $1,200 total for the Mavic with all the accessories. So I think that just makes it a little bit more accessible for people. Now I have the Mavic Pro, and I basically have zero interest in switching to the Mavic Air. But if I didn't have a drone and I wanted one, I would buy the Air for sure, just because of the smaller size. So, any questions, Carl?
No, I mean, I'm still haven't gotten a drone. I'm definitely interested in it. Yeah. But just the price of the ones that look fun to use,
yeah,
are keeping me from getting one, because, you know, I want to get up there, but I don't want to spend that money, and I don't want to get a cheap one.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
just kind of sitting in that medium spot here. That's just kind of holding me off.
Yeah. So if you wanted something that was like semi-professional, slash professional, then the Mavic Air, I would say, is the way to go. The smaller one, the Spark, which is $499, and I think I've seen that on sale for $400. Like, if you really, if you don't care about the videography and you just want to fly it around, then I would go with a Spark. But the Spark doesn't fold down, so I'd have to look side by side. But I think the Air folded up might be smaller than the Spark. I'm not 100% sure on that. So you could fly the Spark a little bit quicker because you don't have to sort of unfold it and go through that whole process. But you know, if you're spending, I guess the Air would be double the cost of the Spark. So again, if you just want a fun drone to fly, get the Spark. Mm-hmm. If you want to do video and, you know, like semi-professional video, higher quality video, then I would go with the Mavic Air. So that's my recommendation. Okay, next one, and I don't know if you want to go through this one, Carl, but I'm harvesting credit card numbers and passwords from your site. Here's how.
Yeah, so this one was interesting. So first of all, as a disclaimer, the author of this says that this may or may not be something that he's actually really doing. But even if he's not doing it, it's something that kind of shows a problem in the system. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of saying that he can get essentially any kind of form information kind of through the same problem that LeftPad had. So when we had that LeftPad issue, you know, it was something that everybody took a dependency on. Everybody was using it. It kind of, when they removed it, then everybody was left hanging. Mm-hmm. So he kind of took that as inspiration as, hey, you know, if I write some code, some JavaScript code, and this could be actually really useful. So he gives the example that, you know, we could have something that for a developer will write color-coded messages to the console. Mm-hmm. And that's something I, as a developer, would be like, yeah, I could totally use that. I could take a dependency on it.
Yeah.
And he's saying that he can deploy code that's open source that will not match, you know, what's available through the repo that you get. So, for example, you can have the source code out on GitHub, you look at it like, all this code looks good. But when he publishes a package to the repositories, that's when he swaps out and puts the stuff with a payload in there.
Yep.
And then in addition to that, he says you can even be smart enough to do this where it's not reporting weird things when people may be working or may notice it or, you know, do all these other things. So you could turn it on and off remotely from his side, only on times when it's least likely to be detected. And then in addition, this code can easily be put into, because it's just JavaScript, into something like a Chrome extension where you have access to see the contents of a web form field, which contains credit cards, passwords, mother's maiden names, those three digits on your credit card that you need to authenticate. And because he's using all these other very subtle techniques, a lot of times you as a user won't notice it. You as a developer wouldn't notice it. And it's definitely a weakness in the system that we don't have a good answer for.
Yeah, I thought that was really clever. The fact that he would not send, you know, requests to his server during business hours so that like the professionals could never reproduce the issue. Mm-hmm. And you bring up such a good point with the, you know, you get that package. I mean, how many people update a package and then go and actually look at the local source that's in that package? Like, never. So, I mean, that's terrifying.
Well, especially if it's minified and some of that stuff is just nasty to look at in that form.
Yeah, and even pointed at a whole bunch of bugs. Like, there's a bug, I guess, I don't know if it's a bug. It's a vulnerability in Chrome where you can avoid sending things through the console so you can't even see the requests. Yeah, or actually what it does is it'll turn off those requests whenever the console is visible.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's pretty terrifying. So fortunately, like at the end, he's like, okay, I didn't actually do this, but you know, he kind of constructs like this, you know, based on our current system, this could be totally taken advantage of. Maybe it is. And this terrifies me just like there's, I don't know if you saw this recent vulnerability where like password managers can fill in common things. And I actually don't use this feature. I'm glad I don't now. But what it'll do is if you go to a page, like a checkout page, and it says, hey, what's your address? It'll fill in your address. It'll fill in your phone number, like all that kind of stuff, just to make the checkout process quicker for you. And what some devious sites were doing is they would have a hidden form that had all that information in it, or that had the, mm-hmm. those fields. Your password manager would fill it out without you even knowing. And now they could track you from all the sites, and they knew your address. So they could actually send you a letter in the mail if they wanted, saying, hey, yeah, we know that you live at this address and you've been viewing these sites. You know, like, how crazy is that? So,
and that would be really, really weird to get a physical mail saying, yeah, here's your browser history.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know, man, this is terrifying. Like, what do we do? Like, I just need like a Mission Impossible style, like second computer, that like burns up every week or something. But, you know, and then I'll have an online identity that is like totally separated. I don't know. How do we defend against this? I guess from a developer perspective, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of packages. And the thing was, this is kind of key in what he was talking about as well. He actually went in, or this is, you know, theoretical, but he issued a pull request to, one of these other packages and said, hey, I fixed this bug and I also made it so that your output is different colors on the console. And of course, you know, if I got that kind of pull request, I'd be like, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, accept that pull request. And now it's not even, you know, you're trusting party A, you know, with the packages that they have, or package A. But inadvertently, one day, without you changing anything, without you just updated to the latest packages, you've now pulled down package B, which has a vulnerability in it. And nobody has time to go look for all those vulnerabilities. So I don't know. Are there any, do you know if there's any vulnerability scanners, you know, that you can, that use like heuristics in your code?
I've heard of a few, but I've never really used those myself.
Maybe we should start looking into that, or find a guest. Cause I think that would be kind of interesting, because, you know, if you're working for a giant important company, like, I don't know, Microsoft, you know, you have to have some way of knowing this. So actually, I bet you there's people we can find within Microsoft that, you know, kind of know how to work with the attack surface here and deal with that. Plus I bet big companies, like, you know, take Apple, for example, I bet you whenever they're building something and they're like, oh, there's a package that does it over there, they're just like, hey, let's hire somebody just to like write this thing, you know, proprietary, in our own stuff. So that's one way. I mean, you could use vast quantities of money to sort of avoid this whole problem.
Don't wait for users to report problems. Raygun gives you complete visibility on errors, crashes, and performance problems affecting your end users. Replicate issues in seconds rather than digging through log files or having to rely on users to report errors or crashes. Raygun gives you a window into how users are really experiencing your software applications. Supports all major programming languages and platforms, and integrates with your current development workflow tools too. There's a free 14-day trial, and it takes minutes to implement. So start resolving issues in your application and check it out today at raygun.com.
Okay, report. 80s kids started programming at an earlier age than today's millennials. Definitely seems that way.
Well, you know, without even getting into this article, I was listening to another podcast recently. I believe it was .NET Rocks, where they were talking about, you know, even fairly recently this change has occurred, because how many of us remember like MySpace, where how customizable it was? You know, people would just go in there and just try to make it as unique as possible. And they would get in there, not trying to code, but just, they just wanted to make this unique site. So they would go in there, figure out, you know, how do we change the markup? How do we do the scripting? How do we do all this other stuff? And they accidentally taught themselves how to be developers.
Yeah.
Whoops. And when you look at the equivalents, you know, social sites today, you have, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat. Those are very locked down environments. You're not going to be customizing that.
What background would you like?
You don't even get that. I mean, the most that you get, like, I know my kids, they're just updating their avatars. So really, they're just figuring out what cartoon images do they want to display. And, you know, they're not having that same ability to discover and learn the underlying technology, because it's all being locked away from them.
Yeah. And then they don't get that feeling, right, of like actually creating something. Like it's, you know, I can't quite put my finger on it, but it's this process of like, hey, I have an idea, and then there's a whole bunch of pain, and then you figure out how to avoid that pain. Right. Or you have like the, there's it, in better words, it's like challenge, you know, challenge accepted, and then, you know, like solution. And it's that process is, you know, from what I've seen, is like what gets a lot of people hooked. That's what got me hooked. And yeah, so I started programming. I don't even know when it would have been. It would have been when I was eight, somewhere between like 8 and 10. And I remember, like, you know, we'd get these magazines, and my dad was in like a user group, and he'd get all these different discs and stuff. But we would get in magazines, they'd have like programs that you could type in, you know, in BASIC. And actually, I was on a Mac, so learning how to program on a Mac was way easier, because you could actually do like GUIs and stuff like that. And there was also HyperCard. You could do some stuff on there. But I remember, like, my dad challenged me, I think when I was like 10 or something. He's, you know, I was playing around with BASIC and making it do stupid stuff, and also with macros. And he said, make a ball that bounces around the screen. And it took forever. And then I even got stuck, like the thing would just like start acting weird. And then he showed me how to fix that. And then we had a ball that was bouncing around the screen. And I think that was when I was like 10. That's so cool, being able to do that.
Yeah. You know, unlike you, I can remember one of my first programming experiences. We had in high school, this like, you know, intro to computers kind of thing. And they're on Apple IIe's.
Yeah.
And they taught us how to do BASIC, but like create this low res graphic. So essentially ahead of time, what most of the class did is, you know, that we had this grid and you kind of figured out what, you know, pictures, you know, pixels you needed to fill in to, you know, make your picture. Yeah. And then you either use lines, and, you know, there's a few different ways to do it faster than defining each pixel color. But by the end of the project, everybody else kind of just like created a picture in BASIC. And I actually created a short movie. Mine was animated using only the skills that they taught us how to make a static low res graphic.
Yeah.
So that was what hooked me, is, you know, like being able to be like, you know, this is cool, but I want to do, what's the next thing?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm trying to really pinpoint it, because my parents, we had a TRS-80, and I used that to play games at home, and that used an audio cassette drive initially before floppy disks, and then we had a floppy drive. But yeah, I remember in school using an Apple II, and I remember like doing some basic stuff, but I think that was like second or third grade. Which is interesting, because that's actually later than when I had the Mac, because we had the Mac when I was 5. Mm-hmm. That was a Mac Plus. And kicking myself for not having saved that. I would love to have that thing now.
Yeah, and I can't even remember what we actually did, but I remember sitting in trigonometry class. Everybody had TI-85s.
Yeah.
And you could program on those.
Yep.
I remember just like wasting a lot of time not paying attention to trig, but writing little programs on my calculator.
85, that was the one that like was super awesome, right? Because there was the 80, yep. What was
they it? They actually had a code button. Like the rest of them, you could do it, but it was like a hack.
Okay, I got to look this up now. Because there was like the normal, there was the TI-86. Let's see
here. I know I had the 85.
Yeah, but the 85 was bad. Oh, it says discontinued in 1997. Well, that could have been the case. But yeah, there was one. So it was more powerful than the TI-81. But it says, so there was the TI-81. Then it says it was replaced by the TI-85 and then the TI-86. Yeah, see, the 86 is like the normal looking
one. Hey, what's ironic is all those calculators are the same price nowadays as they were back then, and nothing's changed about them.
Oh, okay. I think I figured this out. Here's what I was trying to say. Okay, so this is, I got it now. So TI-83 was the one that they told us to use in class. They said that you could use the TI-86, but that it was more complicated.
You got that one and it was awesome.
Yeah, I was in like the advanced math. Well, actually what I did is, so my dad bought me the 83. I was supposed to remember this. And then he goes, I'm only buying you one, so if you break it, you're done, right? Of course I broke it. Not intentionally. I ended up dropping it the one day and it broke it. But I did talk him into buying me that. I think this was it. This was the TI-86 was like way more powerful. Yeah. Cause I'm looking, so they're both 6 megahertz. They're both 6 megahertz, but, of course I just had a notification. Okay, here we go. 24 kilobytes of ROM versus 256. Yeah, and it was a 128 by 64 screen, whereas the other one was only 96 by 64. And yeah, then I custom built a parallel cable because you could get third-party programs on this. Did you ever do that?
Yeah. That's some of what I was talking about.
Yeah, because you could get like a Mario clone. And of course, yep. This thing was not a grayscale screen, but they would emulate it by flashing the pixels. So they could get like eight different shades of gray, or four, you know, however many shades of gray. It was fantastic. So yeah, these were the days. But yeah, I wrote programs. They would let you use these calculators for tests, and I wrote programs to solve all the problems. The only issue I ran into is that whenever we had a test, and there was one where I didn't know how to do the problem, but I wrote the program to do it, you know, so I was having some kind of issue, I would have the answer, and then I would get points off because I didn't show my work. So I should have just handed the program. But anyway, those were the good old days, right? Okay, what were you talking about? So yeah, we started like super early, and personally, it was from zero encouragement from my parents. You know, I don't want to, you know, it's not like they like discourage me, but they didn't intentionally encourage me at all. It was something that I was drawn to, and it was something that was so simple that I could sort of get my head around it. And I've always been concerned, like, you know, you were talking about some of the simple things, but I just think now, like, you and I have so much foundational knowledge about how computers work. And I think kids today, you know, it's like, oh, here, you know, write some JavaScript. And then if they go, how does this work? You're just like, oh boy, JavaScript runs in your browser and it uses this thing. And oh my God, like the complexity there of what's actually going on. Now you can obviously break that down and sort of explain it, but I feel like there's a bigger learning curve now.
Definitely. And especially like when you get into like modern web development, I mean, when you start talking about like, well, not only do you to do like a production, you know, polished website, does it need to have, you know, high-end JavaScript and fancy CSS animations? But, you know, just to get all that to work, you need, you know, node package managers, you need, you know, CSS yeah. precompilers. And it's just like a lot of stuff, a lot of moving parts. And when you're learning, that's very intimidating.
Yeah. So I got another sticker idea for you. When I was your age, all I needed was basic.
So, you know, I'm going to jump us into this, sure. This next topic. I intentionally put this one next. So
okay.
It's called Stories from 300 Developers Who Got Their First Tech Job in Their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, part of it started with like how, you know, I'm X number years old. Am I too old to get hired as a developer? You know, and he even has like a bunch of links, you know, like going 1 year at a time, is 60 too old, is 59 yeah. too old, like all the way down to like 14. And
I mean, is 14 too old?
Yes. Well, I mean, let's look at the story that you gave. You said that you were starting when you were eight.
Yeah.
And like, to be honest, even though I didn't really start till I was in high school, that was just like enough to wet my whistle. And I didn't really do much with that. You know, after I went to high school, I joined the military, I got out, you know, I started going to school for programming, but I took the long route. I had a family, I was working in a factory for 10 years. I didn't get hired as a developer until I was in my 30s. Mm-hmm. So I kind of fit like both of these scenarios. One, yes, I started early, but then I took a huge gap off because life happened.
Yeah.
And then I started when I was 30, and you know, to answer that question is, you know, I'm so old. Is that too old? You know, going to ruin the story for you. No, it's not. I mean, you know, I've been able to have what I call a fairly successful career. Mm-hmm. I've definitely gotten quote up to speed with where I probably would have been otherwise. And, you know, it's for me, it's, you know, what you make of the time that you have,
yeah.
You know, are you into programming and willing to educate yourself outside of work hours? That mm-hmm. will go a long way towards being able to, you know, be successful in your career.
Mm-hmm. And I've definitely thought about this before, right? Because like we keep getting older, like, are we going to run into this situation where that becomes an issue? And I think we're pretty fortunate because we work with such a wide range of ages at work. You know, you will have, I guess I don't want to guess people's ages, but I mean, we have people in their 50s that are working with people in their, you know, lower to mid-20s.
Straight out of school.
Yeah, straight out of school, right? We have a lot of that going on. And I personally have never seen an issue with that. at least in our environment. Now, I'm sure there's other environments that are not as good. I'm sure those are out there, and that's super unfortunate. So I guess if you're in that case, if you're awesome and your team isn't, then, come to Microsoft.
but even at that, I mean, we've had other guests. I think the one that, kind of sparks to mind is when we had Bill Barry on talking about IoT. Like, he came from like a drama and theater, like hardware production, background, working on Broadway and stuff. Yeah. And, a lot of that, when you have those other life experiences, that does help your career as a developer. It gives you different perspective on things, especially if you're going into, a development career that might have a focus that serves the industry that you came from. That's very insightful.
That is such a huge point, right? Because like programming in of itself is not necessarily that useful. I mean, there are plenty of those people where they're at like doing super low level programming where, they're just not even like on the same planet. I mean, it's just they have a function and like numbers come in and numbers go out. And those people, like, I give them a lot of credit. They're super smart and, their brain works completely different than how mine works. But like you said, that's definitely the minority. I mean, there's probably a lot of those people are at Microsoft working on like the low levels of Azure and Windows and those products. But probably the vast majority of programmers out there are more, line of business and focused on something specific. Like, I know you and I, like, we have a good background in like manufacturing, which sort of plays in IoT and those things. Bill was in like show business, which actually works out well for him because it's all the same electronics that they use in manufacturing. that's an amazing background. Actually that's great advice for any people that are listening to this that are, at the beginning of their career. Like, try to pair the technical and the programming part with some kind of specialty. Like, don't just be awesome at, Node.js. Like, that will only get you so far. If you can pair Node.js with some real world problems, let's say it's even automotive or it's
medical,
finance, any of the verticals, that's where you can really be successful. Because if you can come in and say, here's how the medical industry works and here's how software works, because it has its own unique set of challenges. And what always amazes me is how little I know about those verticals. Anytime, because I always think like manufacturing, it seems like everybody should know how all that works. And then I talk to somebody else and they get it completely wrong. And then I go talk to a medical person and, thinking that, I go in there thinking that I have no clue what's going on. And sure enough, like they easily prove that, they sit there and they just talk about, here's how the software gets deployed. Here's how it gets managed. I'm like, whoa, this is totally different than what I could even conceive of. So yeah, having that sort of real world specialty paired with programming, that's what you need to be successful in the field, I think. Okay. Totally switching gears. What does iOS do differently to Android? What the heck here? I can't even read this. What does iOS do differently to Android for iPhones to only need? That's a terrible title. But anyway, yep. What they're saying is you have iOS, you have Android. iPhones only have 1 to 2 gigabytes of RAM, and Android has like bajillions of gigabytes of RAM. So why are they different?
So part of it is like, I like the answer. So definitely hit up the show notes, click on the link and read this, because this is, it does go deep and way deeper than what we're going to talk about. But when we look at the fundamental differences of like the programming models that these are built on. So iOS is built on Objective-C, which is a language that's essentially designed for the kind of platform that the hardware runs on.
Well, it's basically C.
Yep, it's basically C.
Which is basically assembly.
It's basically assembly. It's basically made to run on, it's targeted for these ARM devices that the iPhones are running.
Yeah.
Whereas Android is based upon Java, which originally was architected to be platform neutral. It could run on x86, x64, ARM, MIPS, like all those crazy, like the Itanium stuff too. So there really was meant to run in a virtual machine and have, layers managing it. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, it's like, sometimes we like to compare our phones like, oh, this is the latest and greatest. And why is this one like not have as good specs, but run better and stuff like that. Well, you know, let's look at the, you know, like the history of this. And, you know, Java was built to, you know, handle all these different platform shifts and not being, you know, not having to rewrite your code. Well, in Android's case, it doesn't, it only does have to worry about one platform, but it's built upon something that, you know, did want to abstract that away. So you do have those extra layers.
Yeah. So I think whenever you look at iPhone, I mean, they have control over the hardware and software. I mean, that's kind of the short answer. And they can really try to push costs down, you know, so this RAM is not expensive when you look at a per unit basis. But obviously, when the quantities that they're selling, it gets expensive. For Apple to double the memory, I think would be trivial. There wouldn't be a whole lot of benefit because of how they architect it. Now, if you contrast that with Android, you know, while they were, especially in the beginning, they were far less efficient. You know, I think it was sort of like the Microsoft approach, right? Like in the early days of like Windows, they weren't building for what, how fast computers were, you know, when they started building the operating system, they were targeting like how fast will they be, you know? So Android now, I mean, they can just say like, hey, if we throw an extra like 20 cents, at this problem, we can just throw double the RAM in there. And like, this becomes a non-issue. Which in a way, I mean, is, I guess you could argue which of those two ways is better. I mean, the Android way was certainly easier. But at the same time, like they don't have the same volumes, you know? So if there was a single Android phone, like the iPhone, then maybe they'd be more cost conscious, like per unit, and they would be trying to control that.
Now that same, I mean, these are mostly the same platform. We are really looking at like the difference between ARM, and really that's all the phones are really running. They're not running like x86 or something like that. Yeah. And to give Android a little bit more credit, they are doing as much as they can to kind of shift some of this stuff. But because that's kind of the architectural history, I mean, it takes a lot to move that much code without breaking anything.
Yeah. And then what was interesting in this link, and people have to tell me if this is true, because this is like news to me. It says in here, it says in recent times, Android itself has become far more power aware. So what they are saying is that Android was just, they just didn't care in the beginning and now they care. So it says it runs managed code and its runtime. Android can make power efficiency decisions across all apps that use iOS, or that iOS cannot. This has resulted in a bizarre situation that most developers thought they'd never see, where Android devices now tend to have longer battery life, a few days, than iOS devices, which now last less than a day. What? Is that true? I mean, that's kind of news to me. Maybe it is. I mean, I've been living in my own little bubble here, so maybe that has happened.
Yeah, and I don't know, but if that is the case, let me know.
Yeah. Like every third day I like wake up and I'm like, you know, like the picture of the cat with like the newspaper, that's me. And I'm like, I should switch to Android. And there's a lot of things that I'd love to be using in Android. But man, they are still a second class citizen in some cases, which even that, you know, I'm kind of okay with, but what it usually comes down to is like my family uses FaceTime and they don't have to do anything. It can't crash. It can't get messed up. I just say FaceTime and I call them and it works. So I'd have a really hard time giving that up. iMessage, I could probably live without. My Apple Watch, I maybe could live without if there was I think there's probably a decent substitute out there. So it's really FaceTime. It's just way too sticky. So any day when they open that up, then I can finally switch. Ha ha ha. That's a joke. Okay. So I don't know what you can actually do with this answer. So it sounds like they both just took different paths to kind of get to the same point. Okay. Meet the new dialogue element. I didn't even know this was a thing.
Yeah. So in HTML 5.2, there's now a new, tag that we can use. It's the dialogue element, and you can use that to create native modal dialogue boxes. So this is something that a lot of people have been emulating, creating on their own with their own divs and stuff like that. Yeah. And now you not only will get that out of the box, but if your browser isn't supporting it quite yet, there's also a polyfill for that. Mm-hmm. So you can just grab that. And I mean, we've had this on native programming styles for a long time. So it's nice to see this coming to the web for those who make use of it. Just hopefully it's not for advertisements.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess maybe we picked the wrong article because it doesn't actually say like why this is better. I was trying to figure out like, why is this even a thing? The biggest thing to me is if you, you know, if you use kind of the basic version where you just say like, here's a dialogue and then you say show modal and, you know, you allow it to be closed and things like that. Like if the thing is centered and it just sort of works properly, you know, whereas like when you're using divs and like Z indexes and like all these crazy CSS tricks, you know that if you use it in, you know, I guess if you use it in a browser that doesn't support dialogue, it's probably not going to look right. So the hope is in a few years, like you will be able to assume that this exists. And like you mentioned, you can use a polyfill today, but it seems like, I don't know, again, this article doesn't, I don't think it really sells it, but it talks about some of the features of it. And there is a link to a demo and some code. So I don't know if this is something you're interested in, I would go check it out. And maybe let us know what the big advantages are. It seems right now like there's not a huge advantage to using it, maybe a small one at this point. Thanks a million, John Skeet. This guy is a maniac.
Yeah, he is. So for those of you who do not know, he has pretty much, I think for most of Stack Overflow's existence, been the number one rated user in terms of his score on Stack Overflow. So you get points for asking questions, for answering questions. He's been prolific in the C# and Java tags. So since he hit 1 million points recently, which is quite an achievement, you know, they wrote one of their nice blog posts about him. So some of the things that I thought were kind of interesting, especially right at the beginning, is since Stack Overflow's existence in 2008, he has answered 34,000 questions. And that comes out to about 10
a
day.
That's insane.
But when you look at it, you know, it's not just like a straight line. He did 10 a day. I mean, a lot of those were very early on. He was very active, doing many, many. And he's kind of trailed off. Just kind of shows you how their reputation works. Mm-hmm. You know, you do get, you know, as people keep liking your stuff, the more good answers you have out there, when people find them useful years later, you can still get credit for something you did.
Who is this other person with the line that passed him? Somebody has more answers than him. And I don't know how to find that on Stack Overflow.
I don't know, but they may have more answers, but he has more reputation.
Yeah. Which I think is more important.
Because the reputation is really a measure of the impact that you have.
Wow. Look how many, what do they call those? The
tags?
No, not tags. The medals or the badges. That's what they are. He has 8,000. Is that bronze? I can't tell. what is what here? Well, he's got 7,420 silver. I think gold, he's got 606. And then the bronze, he's got 8,098. There's no hover help on those, I tell you. But anyway, yeah. So of course, that's crazy that he's getting those as well. But this is so cool. And yeah, I recommend going out and checking out these graphs because it shows like the types of questions that he's answering. I get such a kick out of it that he's like the big C# question answer in .NET. Mm-hmm. And he's like the expert there. And it's like, oh, is that what you do during the day? And it's like, nope, I'm a Java developer. I mean, that just baffles me. I can't imagine like being known as like the number one expert in a field, and then that's not what my job is. Like, you know, like C# developer by day, and then I don't know, you know, number one car expert by night or something. Like, it's just really strange to me. But I guess Java and C# are you know, have a lot of similarities. So congrats, John. Very good job. Yep.
Congratulations.
Yep. Open SSH in Windows 10. Woohoo.
Yep. One of our previous episodes, we talked about some other Linux commands that were coming, and they just keep on getting added.
Yeah. So this is, just so I'm clear, this is on the Windows side.
Yeah. So Windows 10, in the right now, it's available in the Insider builds.
Yeah. And obviously it would already be available in the Linux subsystem.
Yeah. So this is available to you just through the regular command prompt, PowerShell prompt, so on and so forth.
That's awesome.
So if you're looking for that native integration, it's now there by default.
Okay, and then our last one here, PowerShell Core 6.0, generally available and supported.
So this one is really interesting because the word around Microsoft from Jeffrey Snover himself is that he believes, as the father of PowerShell, that this is its most impactful, largest update ever. And what this does is kind of like how .NET Core goal was to be available on all the different platforms and work everywhere. PowerShell Core will now run on Linux, Mac, everywhere, GA, out of the box. So yeah, that is pretty awesome.
Yeah, there's so much to cover that we're just going to have him on the show. And then we can ask him all the important questions. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I read like Hacker News and I always go through like the comments and people there's like a love hate relationship. Well, I shouldn't say love hate. There's two different camps on like PowerShell. I mean, the people that love it, like really love it because it's, you know, the people that aren't huge fans are like the scripting people. You know, where they're just like, oh, I can do everything through scripting. But the thing is, they're different. And I guess we'll talk to Jeffrey about this because it's, you know, if it really was just like an alternative to scripting, you know, that kind of did the same thing, but it was just different commands, like it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. So I think it's neat. It's just a totally different way of doing these things. And it's super powerful. Well, that's the name. So I'm really excited to talk to Jeffrey about that.
Yeah. And we use the PowerShell every week to generate the show notes for the website. So without it, I would take much, much longer to do my job.
Yep, exactly. And I think it's so cool it runs on a Mac now too, and Linux. Okay, Azure pick of the week. So I have two, actually my other one isn't even an Azure pick. I screwed that up. And we already had it, but I'll explain in a minute. So my Azure pick of the week is... actually, this one's not even an Azure pick either, but it has Azure in the name. So Azure Functions, which I think just about everybody has heard me talk about, basically Azure Functions has the ability to run in a container. So I've done this recently. I've taken advantage of this. And it's as simple as in your Docker file, there is basically a base image for Azure Functions. So if you have an existing Azure Functions project, which I did, I had one out on GitHub. Mm-hmm. I literally put in a Docker file and I said, I told it to start from the one image, copy my files in and expose port 80. And boom, I now have Azure Functions working in a container. So I can either run that on the cloud or I can run it locally. And the reason I think there's two reasons why this happened. One was for IoT edge scenarios. So you can run it in the IoT edge. So it's similar to like Greengrass that AWS has. But I think this is, just as powerful, if not more powerful. And what's nice about it is you can just run it locally or run it wherever. So, you know, if you just want to run your open source code, or you want to use an open source framework, that lets you do wake up at certain intervals, or you want to monitor blob storage, you want to do HTTP triggers or whatever, just throw a Docker file in there. Now you can containerize it and run the same thing everywhere, which I think is awesome. I think it makes things more, I don't want to say more predictable, but it makes it, you know, it's all the advantages that come along with containers. Like once you get the thing in a container, like it usually, you know, knock on wood, works the same way in dev test or wherever you put that container. And then I have I'm going to move my one pick to the dev tip of the week, and then I'll let you do yours, Carl. So my one dev tip of the week is, so we talked before about SQL Operations Studio on the podcast. I had not used it and I really didn't know what it was at the time. So I'm a huge fan of Management Studio, you know, from SQL Server. Like if you ever talk to a SQL Server database, I install the SQL management tools. And it is, the install has gotten way smaller, but it's still kind of a big install and it only works on Windows. So I did try out SQL Operations Studio and I tried it out on my Mac. And it's for what I use it for, it's actually a great substitute. Like I can go in there and I was writing my queries and you can modify tables and, do things like that. And, it's pretty good. So, you know, again, we sort of announced it before, but it's great for me. Like that's the tool now that I use whenever I want to talk to a SQL database, and it's, you know, super fast to install and super quick. So it's good. It's goodness. So what's your dev tip of the week?
So I've just been using Visual Studio Code more and more often for more and more things. And it's just amazing how many features are packed into it. Not just out of the box, but also what you can add via the extensions. So I found this site called vscodecandothat.com. And it's just shows you like some really useful things. They've got animated GIFs and videos and links to, you know, how all these things work. So it shows you like interactive playground for a project and how you can wrap selections with tags. So if you're working creating HTML, you can select some stuff and just wrap it with a bunch of tags and stuff like that. In fact, some of the stuff they're showing is really advanced. It lets you kind of just really blast out some code really fast and ways to prettyify and add font ligatures.
Yeah, it's good. I was looking at terminals. This font ligatures is like blowing my mind right now. That is so cool.
So
I've just been
Visual Studio. If you wonder if VS Code can do it, the answer is yes. It doesn't matter what it is.
I'm not a fan of the less than or equal ligature, but the that's cool. The triple equals is three lines. So what it's basically doing is whenever you type in like the best one is not equal, so you do the bang equals. It actually does the equal line through it. Yeah, with a line through it. How cool is that? Man, I might have to try that. That's pretty cool. There's obviously a readability issue, but obviously if somebody else is not on your computer, they don't even see it. I assume it stores it as the regular.
It defaults to what it's supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty cool. Oh, this is so cool. Wow. Okay. Well, I learned some things. So I'm happy. Okay, Carl. So don't pick a number, because what I'm going to do is I'm just going to shuffle them, as you can see in the video. And I'm going to pick the first question that has not been used. Okay, what do we got here? Ooh, question number one. Okay. Carl, as a girl, would you rather have really hairy back or really long, curly, exposed nose hairs?
I'm guessing the nose hairs. Yes, that's what I would choose.
I'm sorry, Carl. Okay. I don't know how you're supposed to answer that. Like, those are both terrible.
Yeah, they're not great.
Long, it says really long, like really long, curly, exposed nose hairs. I think you picked the wrong one, because, whoa. You ever see this matrix in here? I was just looking at the VS Code can do that. If you scroll down to integrated terminal, there's different types of shells. Is that built in? That's like it says
right inside. So I'm not sure if that's built in, but it's definitely something that can be extended in.
Okay, hold on. I got to check it right now. So terminal, I got bash. Oh, yeah. See, I only have bash. Okay, so you have to add it in. I'm totally adding that in. That is so cool. Yeah, because you can add different shells like Z shell. C matrix is what it's called. So I'm gonna bing that afterwards here. Okay. So now I'm gonna pick the next available number. Shuffle, shuffle, shuffle. Okay. Would you rather get up one morning and open your dresser to see 100 black widow spiders run out? That sounds pretty good, actually. Or to see 10 large rats run out and hide under the furniture, behind the drapes, and everywhere else. The spiders. Although I guess it doesn't guarantee that they're the only ones. So that's the issue, right? You see 100, mm-hmm. Open your dresser. Oh no. Cause then they'd be in your house.
Yep.
Okay. The rats. Well, they're so much easier to get, right? Like, I'm guessing somebody could come out and just catch them. And I would be done with my rat problem. Our house in Wisconsin was right by the woods. And you think that's a great mm-hmm. thing. But we had mice in our attic. And mice like multiply like crazy. They ended up catching like 20 mice in our attic.
That's a lot of mice.
Probably a good time to move. and it was a new house. I mean, that's what's amazing is they just like got right in. And
okay. But it's right next to the rural areas. That's
yeah,
why.
Yeah. Okay. So where can people find you, Carl?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
And you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. So, Carl, it was great chatting, and it was great recording this so that everybody else can hear our conversation.